Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. So continuing on with the second half of Lungpo Liam's talk, he's describing his own practice when he started practicing. Sitting, there was nothing else to use as an object of concentration, so I would light a candle as a focus. At first, it wasn't a very long candle, just an ordinary white candle like those that the lay people offer. I used it as an object, sitting until the candle would burn out. I didn't sit in a windy place. I lit the candle in a place where there was no breeze, where the flame would stand up straight. I would sit and gaze at the flame, thinking, "What is it that causes this flame?" This was for the sake of clearing away all distractions and memories. Looking at the flame and the halo around the flame, looking and contemplating, this flame has fuel, therefore it ignites. With no fuel, it would not ignite. I took fire, and the impression of the flame is my object. It was a means of destroying mental formations based on the past, and an aid to increasing awareness in the present. I made effort with this, both day and night. Whenever there was sufficient time, and I wasn't tied up with external duties, I would train in this way. 4 days, 5 days at a time, constantly chopping and changing. But it was a lot of suffering. Sometimes various feelings would arise, based on defilement and craving. These feelings seemed never-ending. I didn't know where all the desire was coming from. There was so much of it, so much to endure, like an enormous mountain on top of me, crushing me into dust. There was no way out, no means of escape. Watching and observing brought up the suffering. Whether sitting, standing, or lying down, there was suffering. I stood firmly on the principle that the Buddha would not lie, and kept in my mind that my teacher also encouraged this very practice. So I practiced, not seeing any avenue which might be a means of breaking through, but simply keeping at it. Once I came to the point of feeling that the obstructions and distractions had calmed and settled down a little, from time to time I was able to gain a perspective on myself. To some degree I could perceive internal peacefulness. The samadhi object, like a distant twinkle, though not yet constant or consistent, would arise when self-awareness was sufficient to establish peace. I carried on practicing. By this point, I had a few means for overcoming the various obstacles which would arise. I also had a good teacher giving instruction and leading by example. Therefore, the various obstacles weren't too overwhelming. I carried on doing my own practice in this way. Upon returning from the group meetings and coming to my hut, I went on with my own training. I made use of all means possible to give rise to secluded peace. In those periods of warfare, battling with the proliferations, I would pick up and use as a weapon anything which might be an aid to survival. All of the various reflections and contemplations that we review together, should they bring up any kind of reaction, I would take that reaction as a focus for practice. I would practice to attain peace, and practice to attain insight. There, where one's work of study and investigation lies, the work of contemplation for insight also lies there. As such, anything which would help in bringing together my sense of awareness, I practiced diligently. But I was still conscious of obstacles, for example, the various feelings which arise relating to little things such as eating. Even small matters like this, though nothing major, are difficult to manage. At that time, our community used the system of dishing out each kind of food in equal parts to each member. This took away the opportunity to follow one's wishes, one's feelings, or desires. We used this method at that time because there were few monks and novices, and the food was limited, so we had to do it that way. Also, the monastic rules regarding the distribution of food required that we do it that way. But these days, we can see that the food offered is sufficient for one to select for oneself. But the limitation lies in taking just the right amount for oneself, a skill which is called bhojane matanyuta. This is also difficult to do. Many of us, even practicing this method for some time, still can't get it just right. We should consider, this matter of eating is simply what we do to give the body the support it needs to get by for another day. There's no sense in clinging to some foods as good, others as bad, some as refined, others as coarse, or even seeing what we eat as food at all. It is rather a nutriment for the body to maintain its state of usefulness. There's no point in making anything of the issue of eating. It's not an issue to be concerned about. And there's no point in worrying over the body, whether it will be like this or like that. It's not necessary to burden oneself with such worries. This body shouldn't be taken as belonging to oneself. It is simply a state of nature, a manifestation of material form, and nothing more. Even if one were to give sustenance to the body to the full satisfaction of one's desires, in the end, the time will still come for its inevitable demise. This much we can all see. However, small matters like this remain difficult. It's not the case that they are easy. The feeling that one kind of food is good, another kind not good, one kind of food is suitable, another kind not suitable, was still present within and not willing to abate. It was still a concern, still an obstacle, even though it shouldn't be. One should be concerned with deeper, more meaningful things than this. This matter concerns only the coarse material elements and nothing more. It's not a big issue, but it is still difficult to manage. Knowing moderation in eating means not allowing food to become a cause for worry. One consumes what one is given in a simple and orderly fashion, not making oneself a burden for the hearts of lay supporters. If one selects one's own food, one should attempt to take the right amount, suitable for one's body. This is something we should all try to do. As I worked to consolidate my feelings regarding this external matter, my internal awareness became more and more refined. I tried to build on and make much of this refined awareness in order to increasingly sift through the various feelings. The feelings kept on arising, and I was weighing them up and evaluating them all the time. While eating, what feelings would create disturbance? Before eating, what feelings would irritate and interfere? The various disturbances were simply vedana, pleasant and unpleasant feelings. The unpleasant feelings of hunger and thirst would arise in various forms. At times, pleasant and unpleasant feelings expressing satisfied and dissatisfied states of the body would compete for my attention. Feeling of liking and disliking, this is agreeable and this is not agreeable. Lungpo Cha therefore had us contemplate unpleasant feeling. The experience which arises before eating, what is that like? It is an unpleasant feeling. One is hungry, one is thirsty, one knows nothing but desire. But one has to have patience and tolerance and restrain oneself until it is time for eating. When it was almost time to eat, we had the practice of contemplating our food. We didn't organize our food into separate vessels. All of one's food was mixed together in one's bowl. All of one's food combined together, discouraging feelings of this is good, this is average, or this is not good. All the different types had to mix together. Then we would contemplate the disgusting nature of food for the purpose of abandoning delight and giving up feelings of not having enough, and not being content with what one has or what one gets. I contemplated in this way in order to conquer feelings of hunger, thirst, and desire, all of which are demands which present an obstruction to peacefulness. Then, while we were eating, Lungpo had us continue to contemplate and observe. Naturally, when one eats, one seeks for pleasant flavor in one's food. One seeks for the flavor that one likes, that which one finds satisfying. If one isn't satisfied, sweet is no good, salty is no good, and sour is also no good. It's like that. Then, having eaten, the process continues. Pleasant sensation arises, a pleasant mood arises. The pleasant mood covers up feelings of suffering. It's just the same as, when one changes posture, it conceals the unpleasant feelings of the body. If one doesn't change posture, the body suffers. Happy states and unhappy states of the mind are also like this, constantly changing and concealing each other. In this way, hunger and thirst hide pleasant feeling, and pleasant feeling hides unpleasant feeling. Feelings and moods switch back and forth constantly, each preventing the true nature of the other from being revealed. So I observed, always diligently watching over myself. This was the focal point of my study and practice, continually watching myself with mindfulness. Seeing happiness and suffering both as simply Vedana, as feeling or sensation, one of the five khandhas which make up the illusion of a self. In this way, I observed my relationship to such feelings. If one engages with feelings in this way, one won't become a slave to wanting, a slave to craving. One is able to accept both gain and loss, and the moods and feelings which follow on from gain and loss. One doesn't delight in or give importance to arisen mental objects, neither is one intimidated or hindered by them. Such objects and feelings ease, attenuate, and can be abandoned. Just as when the clouds in the sky thin out, the sunlight shines more brightly, one's heart becomes more and more radiant and cheerful. It's as if one has cleared the darkness and impurity out of one's heart. This practice is a matter that we must apply to our way of living, all the way up to our sleeping and waking. We engage mindful awareness to both our sleeping and waking. We engage with a sense of knowing, not with unknowing. This, in turn, gives rise to a feeling of seeing according to the truth. Whatever should arise, one sees the truth in it. That truth points towards the three characteristics. The truth of all things gathers together in these three characteristics, which are consistent from the beginning through to the end. All conditioned things exist within these characteristics. You probably know of these universal characteristics. Anicca, all things exist in a state which is impermanent, not lasting, and must undergo change. That's the state of things. They have to undergo change. We take anicca as the basis for vipassana. It's the basis for correcting one's view. Therefore, we must bring our attention to this point. Anicca translates as uncertain, unstable, or impermanent. Whether it's happiness, unhappiness, achievement, or loss, if we engage in the manner of craving, we can only suffer. We all know about suffering. Suffering means discomfort. When discomfort arises, it comes from desire. Desire comes from a feeling of depletion. Depletion, thirst, not recognizing fullness, not knowing enough. All of this the Buddha called tanha, or craving. If we don't know enough or recognize fullness, that is a source of suffering. We become slaves to our moods and feelings, to the agreeable and disagreeable mental objects which continually arise according to causes and conditions. This is a matter which we should try to understand. We should investigate the three characteristics as much as we can. Investigate anicca, instability, both of the material elements and of the immaterial dhammas. Whatever mental objects arise, the Buddha said to take the three characteristics as a basis. It's a sword for cutting down the various enemies and maras which arise. So one should have it at the ready. If we engage with states of dukkha or of discomfort under the influence of craving, then we suffer. But if we engage with the power of knowing, there is no suffering. By and large, people engage under the influence of craving and therefore suffer. Anicca translates as unstable. Dukkha consists of those things which are difficult to endure. Anatta means not constituting a self. We must take this understanding as our basis. All things are unstable, and whether pleasant or unpleasant, all things are without an identity or a self, the Anatta Dhamma. We must bring our feelings into accord with these characteristics. Then there won't be anything which will give rise to churning turmoil, chaos, and confusion. Direct knowledge must depend on the three characteristics for its arising. If our view is to become right view, it must depend on the three characteristics. Without the tool of the three characteristics, these things are difficult to achieve. The Buddha therefore instructed that we keep this tool on hand for the purpose of our practice. This tool is for Dhamma practitioners, not for people of the world. It's for use by those who are practicing to destroy the various things which constitute obstacles to peace and freedom. It's not something which worldly-minded people can make use of. Worldly-minded people aren't like that. They don't do what they do for the sake of santi. They simply attempt to achieve that which the world's world sees as happiness. That's what they want. But santi, to which the Buddha attained, destroys the root of worldly happiness. The Buddha said this is the path to give rise to right view. Therefore, as we develop along the path of practice, we must exercise great patience. I feel very comfortable living alone and secluded. There is nothing to tie one down. There is nothing to give rise to worries. This is a different feeling of that of regular people. This is a feeling of peaceful seclusion within oneself. It's the same as a person with no sickness or disease who is untroubled by stress and worries. A sick person, whether lying down, standing, sitting, or walking, worries all the time. They're afraid that they are in danger of death. But someone with no feeling of stress or worry regarding sickness experiences peace and ease. There is thus a difference, which I illustrate as a comparison. One person has no feeling of anxiety regarding any issue, but the sick person worries and stresses, thinking only of their illness, even if one speaks to them of enjoyable and interesting matters. Regarding this, as each of us still has a task to fulfill, we must make the effort to practice together. We must make increasing effort to carry out the role of a samana, a peaceful one. We've been practicing together for some time now, sufficient for each to recognize that what they personally are dealing with. But there is a lot of work remaining. It is no small task. When one is cleaning up, the cleaner things get, the more clearly one can see the dirt. In our practice, the more that peace increases, the more that one can see all kinds of danger in every corner. That is the way it is. This is the meaning of the word bhikkhu, one who sees the danger in the rounds of rebirth. One who recognizes danger is able to escape from danger. If one doesn't recognize danger, one is unable to escape. If one has this attitude, then one's feeling of dispassion will increase, but it won't result in disappointment. One simply sees that this is the way things have to be. Clean water naturally still contains a lot of impurities. In clear and clean water, one can see all the dust particles, no matter how small they are. For as long as our feelings are still coarse, our outlook is also coarse. But if our feelings become more refined, our vision becomes clearer and more refined. Finally, one's sense of caution is ever present, to the point that dirt is no longer capable of interfering with the cleanliness. The cleanliness exists as cleanliness. The dirt exists as dirt. They're separate. The cleanliness doesn't become involved with the dirt. The dirt doesn't become involved with the cleanliness. This is just the same. The peace of seclusion does not become involved with any kind of disturbance. States of disturbance therefore come to an end. From the perspective of a worldly person, there always has to be disturbance. But from the perspective of one secluded and at peace, there is no trace of disturbance. In the same way, a person whose heart is in a state of having laid down every kind of burden is left with nothing which will weigh them down. When a person has no more worries tightening and constricting around their heart, a feeling of spaciousness and freedom arises. This matter is something in which we must practice and train in order to make it a reality. If there are obstacles, we simply accept that difficulties must always come with something new. Like a new robe, for example. When a robe is newly dyed, the dye is not yet set fast, and any accidental spills or stains can easily ruin its appearance. Our practice is just the same. We must sift, strain, and cleanse our heart in order to reveal its purity. We must work and strive to secure the heart's state of peace. Then all of the time that we've spent will have gone for good result and caused us to meet with that which we hoped for. The practice according to these teachings, for the sake of goodness and for the sake of setting our lives upon the right path, we will then walk on a path which is smooth and straight and free from harm and danger. As a result, our lives will be rewarded with santi, the peace and tranquility of seclusion. Therefore, may each of you who have made up your minds to carry out the practice be firm in your determination and in your efforts. Any questions? It's a free distribution book, so it's probably on the free distribution book rack. Santi, Peace Beyond Delusion. It's got two talks in it. I read the first talk out couple years ago, or last year when we did the teachings of the Kruba Ajahns. I read the first chapter of this. Second chapter is also quite good.
How much time did Mokpo Lee came to Wat Phapong when he was 9 months old? Is that correct?
9 or 7.
I think it was 7, and then he had some good experiences in his practice at 9, something like that.
But he'd actually been practicing before that as well. It wasn't that he showed up out of from some ghastly village monastery. He was already looking for practice. They had been practicing.
I was wondering when in his practice that his description of practicing with the candle was, whether that teacher was referring to Lompo Cha or whether it was somebody earlier. And we may not know.
Usually when he says my teacher, he's referring to Lompo Cha.
Right. It's true. Yeah, he doesn't really refer to anybody else.
I don't think he would refer to anyone else as
He refers
his teacher.
To anybody else as his teacher.
There's in the book No Worries,
there's a bit about his life before he went to Wat Phapong. He talks about being on Tudong, practicing.
Sam nandiyam dhammakataya sadhu